In the overheated 2011 presidential primary for the Republicans, there was a fast-rising, charismatic, attractive candidate, Michelle Bachmann, Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann from Minnesota, taking a lot of attention, press scrutiny. And during the press scrutiny, it came out that she credited R. Francis Schaeffer with forming much of her opinion about politics and her worldview. So all of a sudden, the press scrutiny shifted from Michelle Bachmann to Francis Schaeffer in a scandalous way. And they began to go after Francis Schaeffer, the Tea Party guru. And who was this Francis Schaeffer? And at that time, there was a voice that God had raised up who was winsome and articulate and intelligent and understanding of Schaeffer. God had placed this particular voice as a columnist at the New York Times. And so Ross Douthat, a Roman Catholic, rode to the defense of Francis Schaeffer, a Presbyterian, and stemmed the criticism of Schaeffer, the erroneous criticism of Schaeffer, before it ever really took flight. It was an extraordinary thing for us. Many of us watched it thinking this is going to really get out of hand, and Ross was the one that was able to do it in a way that perhaps a special pleading Protestant who was a Schaefferites could not have done it. So we owe him, those of us who were formed by Francis Schaeffer's thoughts in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, owe Ross a great debt of gratitude for stemming that. Now, I first met Ross a number of years ago through a longtime mutual friend and Covenant College alum, Michael Cromarty, who was at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. I asked Mike, would he make an introduction? He did so, and Ross, in subsequent years, has spoken to our World Journalism Institute top grad conference in Washington, D.C. Ross is a magna cum laude, Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Harvard University. He was an editor of Atlantic magazine. He is the youngest regular op-ed writer in the history of the New York Times, which incidentally was started by an evangelical Presbyterian 150 years ago. You'd never know it now. You probably have read his writings, his cultural writings, and his political writings in National Review, Weekly Standard, Wall Street Journal, GQ, many other publications. He has written several books, one of which we have a few copies left, Bad Religion, How We Became a Nation of Heretics. We want to sell those for $10 a copy. We have about a dozen, I think. If you've got one or you want to buy one, just give the money to Mark Murphy and then get Ross to sign it before he leaves. Ross is married to Abigail. Who is also a reporter for the Baltimore Sun and the Smithsonian. She's now doing a book on the history of domestic cats. They have two small little girls under 3 years old. They live in Washington, D.C. It's a great privilege to have Ross Douthat with us. Thank you, Ross.
Before we get to you, Ross, this book on cats, I'm assuming from what I know that this is an expose of the dark, seamy underside of the cat kingdom?
It is. I mean, I don't want to get out ahead of myself because my wife hasn't actually finished writing the book, but it is hopefully a book that both cat lovers and cat fearers and despisers can appreciate equally. It will be an even-handed portrait of the role that class of predators plays in our everyday existence.
All right. Christians are always interested in the pilgrimage of other believers. So tell us something about how it is that you became a Christian.
Well, so I grew up in southern Connecticut in the 1980s, and I was baptized an Episcopalian, and my parents were both Ivy League graduates. My father was a lawyer, and we had a sort of, I would say, a fairly conventional mainline Protestant, politically liberal, religiously lukewarm kind of background. And then mostly that changed mostly because my mother had essentially a variety of illnesses, chemical allergies, the kind of stuff that sort of gets folded into categories now, like environmental illness, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, these kind of issues that where the sort of pathology isn't entirely clear. But that was in an era before you had, you know, if you go into the supermarket now, you'll see a row of detergents that say free of perfumes and dyes. You know, you'll see sort of products pitched to people who have these kind of weird reactions. And there was none of that when I was growing up. And so we ended up sort of wandering in strange health food centered worlds and eating tofu before tofu was cool. And along the way, one of the things that happened was my mother had a friend who said, well, you have all these weird illnesses and reactions. Why don't you come with me to a faith healing service? This woman had a healing ministry in southern Connecticut that involved prayer and laying on of hands and so on. And my mother went and was slain in the spirit on the floor of a high school auditorium in Milford or Danbury. I can't remember which Connecticut town. But that was a sort of transformative life event. And it led to this period when we spent a lot of time in charismatic Christian circles, probably both Protestant and Catholic, though we weren't even that aware of some of those divides at the time. But we sort of migrated through. We spent some time in Pentecostal churches. My parents were involved briefly with a failed attempt to plant a kind of evangelical church on Yale's campus. And so I had this kind of sort of double life in my childhood where during the week, you know, I went to a private school outside New Haven that was liberal and very secular and, you know, sort of very what you think about when you think about sort of the liberal Northeast or I suppose the liberal Pacific Northwest in certain ways. But and then on the weekends I went and watched my parents speak in tongues. So that was, you know, not a combination that most of my classmates had. But basically, my mother was sort of mostly the driving force behind our religious pilgrimage. And at a certain point in my teens, after this experiment at Yale had fallen apart, she ended up converting to Roman Catholicism. And for her, she was a very mystical personality, and there was sort of a bridge between some aspects of charismatic Protestantism and some of the sort of mystical traditions in the Catholic faith, you know, the sort of lives of the saints and that kind of thing. And for me, it was more intellectual. I was, you know, reading C.S. Lewis and G.K. Chesterton and sort of had a fairly conventional, you know, how do you become a Catholic? But I was a Christian and sort of aware of the difference of Christianity from the rest of the world I was living in from a very early age. And then I went to Harvard, and you know, if you go to Harvard as a religious believer and as any kind of conservative, you will either lose your faith and your beliefs immediately, or you will be completely confirmed in them. And so I fell into the latter category. I looked around and said, well, this is all crazy. Obviously, I need to stick with Christianity instead. So here I am today.
So between the time of your youthful introduction to the Christian faith and your description of its recent history and your critique of its life, who would you say, besides perhaps Lewis and Chesterton, who you just mentioned, have been the most formative influences on the way you think about your faith and how you practice it?
Well, because when I was a teenager, this was the late 1990s, and probably the most important influence for me was my parents started subscribing to First Things magazine, which some of you may be familiar with, and it's an ecumenical religious journal that had a strong Catholic imprint, because the editor for a long time, Richard John Newhouse, was a Lutheran pastor who had become a Catholic priest. And so I was sort of formed, I mean, Newhouse was probably the strongest contemporary intellectual influence, but more generally I was sort of formed in that, his circle's view of sort of the state of religion and politics in the United States. And I mean, I think Newhouse occupies a role in Catholicism not unlike Francis Schaeffer's role in certain ways for a lot of Protestants, sort of this coming out of the debates of the 1970s and sort of seeing the American religious landscape as being defined by a still very religious country with a very secular elite, and seeing this sort of deep conflict between in many ways the beliefs of ordinary Americans and the beliefs of people who live in places like Washington, D.C., and seeing as well, and this is something Schaeffer and Newhouse very much had in common, the importance of a kind of Catholic-Protestant co-belligerency in culture war struggles, in sort of specific conflicts like abortion, but then more broadly in the struggle to sort of define the terms of debate in the culture as a whole. And so that was, I mean, again, it's a fairly conventional story for people with my mix of religious and political views, but that was sort of where, you know, coming into my 20s, sort of beginning my career as a journalist, those were sort of the assumptions that I carried with me. And then the book itself and the argument that I make in the book, and I guess make in columns and blog posts today and so on, is in certain ways a sort of, it's a sort of, you know, there are generational issues, right? One generation sort of has a set of battles to fight and issues to think about, and then another generation comes along and maybe tries to look at things from a slightly different vantage point. And so that's sort of what I try to do in the book. I sort of say, well, you know, we've thought about the culture war and sort of the Christian mission in these terms for a long time, this sort of, and particularly the idea of sort of a, you know, sort of secularism locked in combat with various forms of Christianity. And I thought it was useful to sort of step outside that frame a little bit and look at what's happening in the parts of American culture that aren't actually influenced by, you know, First Things magazine or, you know, Richard Dawkins and the New Atheists, because I think a big part of the story of religion in America is not sort of this binary choice between secularism on the one hand and mere Christianity, small o orthodoxy, on the other. It's the incredible power of what in the book I call heresy, basically, these ideas that are religious ideas that are sort of deeply influenced by Christianity but depart from historic Christianity, both Protestant and Catholic, in important and ultimately potentially destructive ways.
Okay, we'll get back to the book in a bit, but you worked at, you're a young man, but you've already been a senior editor at Atlantic. You've written books. Just tell us how you...
I have thinning hair, though, yeah. To prove, demonstrate.
Tell us how you made your way into that calling. Were you always to be a journalist? The fact that your parents were writers?
I always wanted to be a writer, but I had... the plan was to be a fantasy novelist. Don't laugh. Game of Thrones, that should have been me. You know, HBO should have been. No, there's a sort of colleague of mine in political journalism named Christopher Caldwell who has this line that every political journalist is either a failed politician or a failed novelist. And I'm not a failed politician, but I do have a fair amount of fiction locked in drawers and hidden files on my computer, probably never to see the light of day. But so I had a vision of myself as being a more, I guess you could say, creative writer in the sense of sort of dealing in either fiction or more narrative nonfiction. But I also, in college, I had edited the conservative newspaper at Harvard and written the token conservative column for the Harvard Crimson, thereby preparing me for my life's vocation. And And I needed a job after college, and I had interned at National Review, the conservative magazine in New York, and the only place that I was offered a job after college was by the new owner of the Atlantic magazine, which is a political magazine that is not a sort of partisan publication. It's sort of like the New Yorker, but a little more politically ecumenical, I guess. And he was hiring people. The magazine was then based in Boston still, but he was based in D.C., and he wanted to start a satellite office in D.C., and he offered me a job as a researcher, and I took it. And, you know, your career is sort of shaped by where you are and who you're surrounded by, and even though I sort of stepped out of that world a little bit to write, the first book I wrote was about Harvard and about undergraduate education there. And maybe if that book had been a huge bestseller, I would have taken a different career path. But it wasn't, and so I just kept plugging away as a journalist based in Washington, D.C., and eventually the Atlantic magazine was moved to Washington, and I sort of clawed my way into actual editorial responsibilities and, you know, wrote a lot of... I mean, the thing about career in journalism is that, especially now, as the Internet has sort of disrupted things and made it more of a hustle, I think, in ways it used to be in the 1930s and 1940s, maybe. You just write, you know, I would write for anyone who would let me write for them. And that meant mostly writing about politics. And so that just became the path that I was on and have remained on. And I mean, part of the reason to write a book like this about American Christianity is also to sort of, even though I write about religion in my columns, to sort of step outside of the, you know, outside of horse race politics. And I was talking to some people just before about healthcare policy and sort of the nightmarish tangles of those issues. But yeah, I mean, it's been interesting because I feel like I'm more interested in American politics than 99% of the population of the United States, but I'm less interested in American politics than at least 70% of the population of Washington, D.C. And so there's always that slight tension in my professional life where I'm always talking to people who are like, and did you see this bill came up on the floor and, you know, this senator did this? And I'm like, oh, dear God. So that's, yeah, okay. that's sort of the trajectory that I've been
you
on.
You mentioned your first book on Harvard. Derek Halverson mentioned that last night as his introduction to you. So give us the gist of that book.
Well,
Harvard, the education.
Education of the Ruling Class. Yes. So that was a book, when I worked on it, there hadn't been a good book about, or I felt there hadn't been a good book about undergraduate education in elite universities in a long time. And, you know,
was it inspired at all by Buckley's
Oh, well, of course,
book?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I mean, obviously, when you're a young man writing a book about your elite college experience from a conservative perspective, you tell yourself, this will be just like God and Man at Yale, and then at the end of it, someone will give me a yacht and a television show, and the rest of my life will just carry on from there.
Yeah.
So, it certainly was. But even more, I mean, if you go back and read God and Man at Yale, it's very focused on political controversies. And that was sort of the template for books about college. And Dinesh D'Souza's book, A Liberal Education, that came out in the 1990s, was sort of in that vein. And I was trying to write, I ended up writing a more personal book because I was trying to sort of explain what, you know, how this campus experience feels from the inside and how that experience sort of shapes, you know, the people who then go on to work in Washington and New York and Los Angeles and theoretically set the tone for the culture and so on. So it was a weird, it was a hybrid book. It was sort of, you know, one chapter would be very memoir-ish and include lots of embarrassing details about drunken escapades and so on, and then the next chapter would be more sort of focused on a critique of, you know, the academic program at Harvard. I don't know if that, not every reviewer felt that that combination was entirely successful, so... But it's highly recommended. Available on Amazon.com for low, low prices.
Bob mentioned that you are a magna cum laude graduate of Harvard, but we've heard that Harvard is the easiest A there is.
Yeah, magna cum laude doesn't really mean that much. I mean, the My wife was actually I met my wife at Harvard, and she was a much more diligent student than I was, and I think you folded in Phi Beta Kappa, but she was junior Phi Beta Kappa. That was actually that was a sign that you'd actually done some work at Harvard. But no, I mean, the way it works is I think people misunderstand in certain ways the roots of grade inflation, though, at schools like Harvard, and this is part of the argument that I made in the book, is that people say, well, this is a sign that, you know, kids at Harvard don't work hard, right? And that, you know, it's intellectually lazy and flaccid and sloppy and so on. And that's not really right. Kids at Harvard work insanely hard, but they work insanely hard on building their careers. And the academic side of things is only central if, you know, you're planning to go get a PhD in history or something. And so what that means is, again, it's not that people, you know, don't write the term paper and sort of, you know, laze their way through class. It's that people need that B plus A minus. It's the, you know, the gentleman's B. It used to be the gentleman's C. Now it's the gentleman's B plus. People need that because it's part of the sort of the expectation for their resume. And so there's all the pressure on professors to not give out C's and D's is not a pressure of laziness. It's a pressure of careerism. And I think that distinction is actually really important for understanding sort of the American elite writ large, that it's this sort of, it's neither laziness nor just sort of, you know, it's the elite is very liberal, but it's not. The liberalism is subordinate to the careerism in a way, that it's more important to understand the insane competitiveness of the American meritocracy and understand its politics in that context rather than just sort of start with liberal politics and go from there. The competitiveness is the most important part.
Okay, the book that has introduced most of us to you is Bad Religion, How We Became a Nation of Heretics. Where did the idea for that book come from? I mean, what made you think of this subject as worthy of your effort in writing a book?
I think it came from the experience of being a journalist, would-be pundit, writing about religion and politics after the 2004 election. And those of you who follow these kind of debates too closely may remember that after 2004, after Bush was reelected, there was this sort of liberal panic about how, you know, evangelical voters had put him in the White House, and, you know, there was that this was a sign that somehow theocracy was on the march, and you had books written with titles like American Theocracy or Secular America Under Siege, and you had this sort of wave of paranoia about how, you know, churchgoers at Faith Presbyterian were going to, you know, impose Calvinism on writers for the New York Times through politics somehow or something.
Yeah,
and right, no, you're working on it. That's why I'm here. I'm the entering wedge. So that also then, I think because of the shadow of 9/11 and the role of radical Islam in those attacks, you had this more generalized mood in the American in sort of Western intelligentsia that, you know, fundamentalism, religious fundamentalism was this huge problem. And maybe religion itself was this huge problem. And so you had the Richard Dawkinses and Christopher Hitchenses having these debates about whether religion was poisoning everything and so on. And from participating in those debates and having the sort of standard religious conservative versus secular liberal, believer versus atheist kind of arguments, it just, I think, especially coming out of my childhood background and the sort of tour we'd taken of American Christianity, I just had a sense of sort of the insufficiency of those debates, whatever side you were on, for understanding what was actually happening with religion in America. So I wanted to write a book. The original idea for the book, it was just going to be called Heretics, which is, some of you may know, a book by G.K. Chesterton from the 1920s where he just sort of takes on different figures. And I was just going to do that. And I was going to have sort of chapters on contemporary religious and intellectual figures who I thought embodied this kind of, you know, religiously pseudo-Christian kind of spirituality that I think is actually the dominant force in American life today. And then I pitched the book to publishers, and they said, well, that's very interesting, but we want you to tell us a story about how we got here. And so if you actually read the book, you'll find that the first half is very historical and starts in the 1950s, in the post-war era, in this sort of Christian revival that followed World War II. It starts with figures like Billy Graham, Reinhold Niebuhr, Fulton Sheen, Martin Luther King, and then talks about how institutional Christianity has weakened in America over the last 40 years and how these alternative pseudo-Christianities have taken its place. And then the second half of the book is more like the original conception I had, where I'm taking contemporary figures, you know, Elizabeth Gilbert, the author of Eat, Pray, Love, Joel Osteen, Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code, Oprah Winfrey, who I gather was in Seattle just yesterday, or maybe she's still here today. And sort of talking about, sort of, in a sense, taking pop theology seriously as theology and figuring out why it appeals to people. And just sort of, the idea in part was saying, look, you know, most Americans aren't, you know, they're not reading papal encyclicals, they're not reading Calvin's Institutes, but they're also not reading Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens. They're going into the bookstore, going to the religion and spirituality section and picking up something by, you know, Deepak Chopra or Eckhart Tolle or, you know, Eat, Pray, Love or something. And for anyone, I mean, the book is both saying, for anyone who's interested in the shape of American culture and the future of American culture, you need to understand this stuff and what it means. But it's also saying something more specific to Christians. That is, you know, when you think about the Christian mission and challenge in the 21st century, this is stuff you really need to understand.
The narrative is complex.
Yes.
It involves a lot of people. Yes. It involves institutions, individuals, events, trends. How long did it take you to research and write that book?
Well, that's sort of a loaded question. It took me 2.5 years to write the book. But the reality of book writing is that it's all deadline driven. So the first year I did an awful lot of reading and research, which largely involved going on Amazon and buying out of print books written in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s by people involved in these controversies, Catholic and Protestant, and sort of trying to get a handle on how it actually felt to live through that era. But then the reality is the book was due just when our first child was due, and I like to tell people that my wife delivered and I did not. So much of the book, and this is a dangerous thing to tell people who haven't read it, but much of the book was written in the sort of post-birth stupor of the first 9 months of parenthood, where I would stagger out to coffee shops, again, toting these stacks of books, unshowered, unshaven, you know, with 5 shots of espresso poured in to keep me awake, and then frantically writing. So this is the reality of the writing life is that I hope that the book I hope that the portrait that it paints is accurate and illuminating. And I did everything in my power to make it so. But there is also an element that readers always need to keep in mind, that books are written by actual human beings under sort of very interesting forms of duress. And there's a reason that, you know, great novelists are usually terrible people to people in their families. So hopefully that wasn't the case. We're still married. We had another child.
Yeah,
you know, so
yeah.
Can't have been that bad. But
a former professor of mine, who was a professional church historian, reviewed your book. I don't know if you've seen that review in a theological journal, and thought it was a superbly accurate account of the trends that you were.
It's very gratifying to hear.
He had nothing bad to say about the book. On the other hand, the review by a liberal Roman Catholic in the New Republic,
yes,
savaged the book. So, obviously, somebody who reads that book from one side or another is either finding a worldview confirmed or attacked. Is that your sense of the response to the book that you at least have seen?
In part, yes. I mean, I think that in certain ways, especially in Catholicism, where you do have this, you know, the church has basically just been divided in the West for the last 40 or 50 years over what the Second Vatican Council meant and where the church should go from here. And in part, the book is sort of written for my generation of Catholics to try and sort of put those debates in context and maybe help us start to move beyond them. But there were certain ways in which the reviews just recapitulated those battles where you would have, you know, a liberal Catholic just saying, the writer for the New Republic just read it through the lens of Ross Douthat is a conservative Catholic. He's saying critical things about what liberal Catholics did in the 60s and 70s. Therefore, I must savage him. But there were also, the review in Commonweal, a liberal Catholic publication by Peter Steinfels, who used to write the religion column for the New York Times, was, made some similar criticisms, but was much more sort of respectful and I think saw more clearly what I was trying to do. So there was more, in general, there was a breakdown where if you were theologically traditional, orthodox, or something, you were more likely to like the book. But I did have, I think, a fair number of more sort of theologically liberal readers and reviewers who read it in the way I wanted it to be read, which is to say, I think if you look at the story of American Christianity over the last 40 or 50 years, I think the failure of the liberal alternative is clear. But the success of conservative Christianity is not. So it's not that it's inappropriate for conservative Christians to feel in any way triumphalist at the ongoing disintegration of many liberal churches, because our position is not so much better than theirs. It is better. It is more solid and more resilient and so on. But there are certain ways in which we're all, liberal and conservative, sort of groping for answers to the problems that I try and describe in the book.
I think most people who read books seriously wonder from time to time, when an author began his book, began the research, began the writing, did his mind change about anything along the way? Or had he already made up his mind and did his research and did his writing in keeping with that original intention? This covers so much material. I'm just curious to know whether you found things in your research that challenged previous opinions or...
I would say that what was most striking, what was most unexpected for me was the in the process of trying to take seriously these forms of pop theology with which I obviously disagree, I do think that I came to a greater appreciation for why people are attracted to them. And the specific example that I use here is the book Eat, Pray, Love by Elizabeth Gilbert, which I was sort of aware of as a cultural phenomenon, but had not read before I embarked on this writing project. And I was...
You better just summarize.
Right, so this is a book, Elizabeth Gilbert, it became a movie starring Julia Roberts. It's essentially a religious memoir written by a magazine writer in her, I guess then she was in her early 30s, about... The conceit of the book is that she goes and spends 3 months in Italy, that's the eating, 3 months in India, that's the praying. Notice you don't do the praying in Italy because, and then the love is in Indonesia and Bali. And that's where she's going through a divorce, and that's where she finds a new lover, I guess you would say. And that was how I understood the book, and I knew it had a spiritual element, and it seemed to me that it was this huge bestseller, 187 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, just probably the most successful religious memoir of our era, equivalent to the success that Thomas Merton's Seven Story Mountain, his sort of Catholic conversion narrative, had in the 1950s. And So I went into that book expecting it to just be sort of, you know, Oprah religion, you know, the world and God and pantheism and, you know, follow your bliss and that kind of stuff. And it is, right? I mean, it is. It's a book that in certain ways totally confirmed my prior assessment that you know, you have this sort of religious impulse that's being expressed in a completely individualistic, do-it-yourself kind of way, where there's no sense that you would ever need to submit to any power higher than yourself, or any authority higher than yourself, right? So that, you know, you can have all these religious experiences and then do with them as you will, and there's no scripture, there's no church, there's no any kind of sort of tradition or anything that sort of forces you to really challenge your own assumptions. But at the same time, it's a book that really, I was really struck by the, you know, as someone who, again, came out of a background where I spent a fair amount of time in charismatic Christianity with people sort of seeking after mystical experiences as a kid, the authenticity of that side of her quest was very striking. And it was, you know, this was a woman who was, you know, a sort of, I guess, had a background similar to mine originally, upper middle class, some sort of liberal Protestantism in her family tree, but fairly secular. And she was someone who, in a quest for the encounter with the divine, ended up, you know, in an ashram in India, having the kind of experiences of something ultimate that, you know, are just not the conventional fodder of Upper West Side journalistic dinner parties or anything remotely like that. She was somebody who really sort of ventured out into the unknown and had the kind of encounters that sort of charismatically inclined believers tend to have. And so I think that combination of sort of having my sort of philosophical priors confirmed, but also sort of being in certain ways really impressed by the rawness. I mean, the reason her book is such a good read is because it's not sort of dressed up and, you know, it's a sort of very raw description of what sort of mystical experience can feel like and sort of the strange difficulty of sort of spiritual journeys and so on. And I think that combination is, I tried, you know, maybe unsuccessfully, but I tried to sort of write that into the book to sort of, because it's important, again, for anyone, but especially for more, I would say, theologically serious Christians to really understand that what these sort of dominant religious ideas in the culture are not, you know, they're not about a rejection of, you know, the desire for God, right? I mean, the desire for God is palpable on not every page, she eats a lot of pasta, but many pages of, I mean, the desire for God is present in the devouring of pasta too, probably, but it's, you know, it's palpable in that book. And I think that sort of keeping that in mind when we're grappling with what is sort of insufficient or, you know, shading into outright destructiveness about these pop theologies, it's just important to keep in mind the authenticity of the desire. And, you know, I would go on, this happened more after the writing of the book, but, you know, I have a lot of very negative things to say about Joel Osteen in a chapter on prosperity theology and sort of on, you know, that style of religious witness in the U.S. And, you know, the point I make, and I think it's correct, is that, you know, Joel Osteen is sort of 50% of Billy Graham. He is, you know, all of the sort of ecumenical open-handedness that made Graham more successful than a lot of fundamentalist preachers in the 1930s, but without any of the, you know, Graham, you know, always laid such a heavy stress on, you know, sin, the cross, the possibility of damnation, and so on. And that's all absent in Osteen. So it's like, I mean, and this is sort of the what I mean when I talk about heresy, right? That it's sort of, it has a big chunk of what we think of as the Christian message, but it's missing sort of, you know, it's like a body with a heart but no lung or something. And I believe everything I wrote about Osteen. But, you know, I would go on a radio show and, you know, give this spiel and talk about my critique of him, and people would call in and they would say, look, you know, Mr. Douthat, Usually they'd say, Mr. Do That, you know, but Mr. Dowson, I hear what you're saying totally, and I understand, you know, all the problems with Osteen, but there was a moment in my life when I just couldn't believe that God existed or could possibly love me, and, you know, I turned on Osteen, or I picked up his book, and that message of God's universal love was what I needed to hear right there in that moment. And again, I think that that's, you know, it's really important in critiquing these things to keep in mind that, you know, because they're heresies, a piece of the truth is still there, and people are responding to that truth. And you can't just say, you know, you can't just sort of, you know, yeah, you have to understand what draws people to those theologies and what is authentic about and even, you know, praiseworthy about the desires that make those kind of authors successful.
One of the most extraordinary developments, I think, in recent days for believing Christians, I mean, people who take the Bible seriously, who take the supernatural character of our faith seriously, is the way in which we are relating to Roman Catholics, and Roman Catholics are relating to us. Evangelicals and Catholics together, which was born out of First Things, included the signatures of a number of men we would have considered our heroes, James Packer, Chuck Colson. But I think most of us are still so unfamiliar with developments in the Catholic Church. Our narrative would have been a caricature in almost all respects. So if you could give us just in 5 minutes a resume of the story that you told in the book about the similar or at least related developments in Roman Catholicism to those in mainline Protestantism, I think that would be intriguing to a number of us.
Sure. I mean, I think that there theological differences notwithstanding, there is a clear parallel between what happened in American Protestantism in the 60s and 70s and what happened in the Catholic Church. And it's part of why I think when I'm talking to Catholics, it's important not to sort of overstress, you know, the impact of the Second Vatican Council specifically. Obviously, that was this huge sort of hinge point for the Church, but some version of these debates would have happened even if there hadn't been a council. I think it was just sort of the way the times were moving. But basically, you had a large number of especially younger Catholics who came of age in the 60s and 70s who had beliefs similar to what were then the sort of liberal Protestant beliefs in the air. And sort of, there's a book by Harvey Cox called The Secular City that's a sort of famous statement of, I think, sort of the liberal Protestant view of things at, you know, and in that moment in the 1960s, which was basically, and the idea was basically that it was more important for Christians to focus on, as the title suggests, sort of the secular city and, in a sense, building the kingdom of God here on earth, and that the Christian horizon needed to be focused more on the secular than on the supernatural, more on the imminent than on the transcendent, and that there was an opportunity here in this sort of new global civilization and so on to, you know, I mean, it has similarities to the social gospel ideas of the late 19th century, but basically just to sort of do the work of God on earth in new ways, and in ways that were, you know, would sort of carry us beyond some of the theological disagreements of the past. And that was, I think, just the defining mood for both mainline Protestants and just a lot of Catholics for a generation. And it's, in certain ways, it's more visible in the Catholic Church because, you know, it's because it's more physically visible in certain ways. Like, if you go into a Catholic church that was built in 1942, and then you go into a Catholic church that was built in 1968, the odds are that the Catholic church that was built in 1968 will look indistinguishable from a secular building. And the Catholic church built in 1942 will look like what you would all expect a Catholic church to look like, you know, stained glass windows, altar, and so on. But that sort of architectural shift, I think, was symptomatic of the entire intellectual shift. The idea being that, you know, the church and the secular world should be partners. They should be partners in what were essentially political projects, essentially the project of building a more just society on earth, and that this focus was much, much more important, you know, and again, in Catholicism, I mean, there was, in certain ways, there were elements in this mood that I think a lot of even conservative Protestants would have been sympathetic towards, because it was a sort of, you know, it was, let's take the statues down, you know, let's not say as many rosaries, let's not be so focused on, you know, on saints and breviaries and Stations of the Cross and so on. And but instead of it being in sort of the classical Protestant mode saying, and let's refocus on Jesus and Scripture, it was saying, let's focus on the things of this world and sort of implementing the Christian vision on earth. And that was, and then that then in turn provoked what became, what's the kind of, what we think of now as sort of the John Paul II, Benedict XVI, more conservative reaction. But it was a reaction, you know, John Paul and Benedict were both men of the Second Vatican Council who had been liberals in the 1950s and 1960s, and who had been in favor of and remained in favor of most of the reforms that the Second Vatican Council actually did, the sort of opening, you know, the ecumenical opening, the shift the Mass into English, and so on. But their view, and the view then of a lot of that generation of Catholics, was that all of that had then gone too far, basically, and that the sort of collapse, that the attempt to sort of combine secular and Catholic purposes had just sort of led to a collapse of Catholic identity, in which it was just sort of, you know, Catholicism was just becoming what, again, a lot of, I think, mainline Protestant churches became, which is this, the sociologist Christian Smith has this line, moralistic therapeutic deism, which is basically just the idea, there's a God, he wants you to be happy, you'll go to heaven when you die, be nice to people, don't be a jerk, that's Christianity, right? And that was sort of where, that was where I think John Paul and Benedict saw the Catholic Church drifting. And, you know, this was then, and this was also playing itself out institutionally, where you had, you know, collapse in seminary enrollments, collapse in mass attendance, the same sort of thing that happened on a larger scale in the mainline churches, where it was like, well, if, you know, if this is Christianity, fine, but why do I have to get up on Sunday and, you know, mouth the whole Nicene Creed? And, you know, we don't believe in that stuff anymore. Just be a nice person, right? And sleep in. And so that sort of, that then became the grounds on which this sort of intra-Catholic civil war has sort of been fought for the last 30 or 40 years, where you have the more liberal wing of the church is more focused on, you know, ideas about that this, you know, the central mission of the church is social justice, and sort of implementing Jesus's vision about the poor in more political terms. And then the conservative wing of the church is more focused on sort of restatements of Catholic dogma, you know, what do Catholics actually believe, and also on issues related to sort of what we think of as the culture wars, abortion, sexuality, marriage, and so on. And so, in a sense, the division between what Protestants think of often as sort of the division between mainline and more conservative churches over, you know, what Christianity should be about going into the 21st century has played out within the walls of the Catholic Church with a specifically Catholic flavor, and the lines of debate are very different. And again, you know, you have sort of, you know, debates over liturgy that really don't map onto Protestant debates, I think. But the overall question, I think, is very similar to the question that has divided divided Protestants, and it is just, you know, to what extent is the church supposed to still be focused on the transcendent on the one hand and on sort of personal moral conduct, versus how much is the church supposed to be focused on sort of social justice, social sin, structures of sin in politics and society. And so on.
In the Protestant world, it's a bit easier to see where all of this is going. I mean, actuarial types can tell us that the Episcopal Church will disappear at 11:32 in the morning on Tuesday, the 14th of February in the year 2019. 84 or something like that. That's, but how do you see this playing out in the Roman Catholic Church over the next 30 or 40 years? Which side is in the ascendant at the present? At least in the American
Catholic
Church.
Well, right, and this brings us to Pope Francis, the figure of the moment. And I think that, you know, in the Church for the last 25 years, clearly the more sort of conservative, traditional, neoconservative, whatever term you want, side has been in ascendance. And that has, I think, borne fruit for the Church in the sense that it has created a sort of resilient Catholic subculture sort of within the large, complicated mass that is American Catholicism. There is a sort of, you know, a subculture that is, you know, large families, thriving parishes, successful religious orders, and so on. But that resilience then contrasts with the sort of total disappearance of a lot of the more liberal religious orders, and, you know, the sort of struggle that the liberal wing of Catholicism has had most of the same struggles with manpower and morale that mainline Protestantism has had. Catholicism is so much larger than the Episcopal Church, that there, you know, the same actuarial issues just don't apply, you know, but there is a sort of similar dynamic at work. But at the same time, the resilience of sort of traditional Catholicism has not led to a large-scale recovery. The number of priests going into seminary has stopped falling and stabilized, but there's nothing like a recovery to the levels the Church had in the 50s and 60s. Mass attendance stabilized and fell again a bit during the sex abuse crisis period, and has stabilized again, but, you know, again, still at a very low level. And then if you dig into, I mean, the media exaggerates the extent to which Catholics' dissent from church teachings, especially on issues surrounding sexuality, because it looks at all Catholics instead of looking at Catholics who actually attend Mass and so on. But even there, if you look at sort of, you know, Mass attending Catholics, you know, the average Mass goer is much more liberal on sort of those both sort of moral and theological questions than is the magisterium of the Church. And so this is sort of where, you know, I think the optimism surrounding Pope Francis in many ways is, it's the idea that maybe there's a kind of synthesis out there, right? That you don't, you know, that you don't have to have this civil war lasting into eternity within Catholicism, that you can have a leadership within the Church and figures within the Church who can sort of simultaneously, you know, maintain the Church's positions on moral and doctrinal issues while also being more successful at outreach than certainly a figure like Pope Benedict, who I, you know, as someone who likes to read his books, really admired, but, you know, I mean, he's not a figure for the media age, let's say. And his resemblance to the Emperor Palpatine from Star Wars was admittedly somewhat unfortunate. And so that's, you know, the hope is basically that the Church can insert at some point, you know, you don't resolve every debate, but you transcend them and you say, look, you know, the gospel of Jesus Christ is about helping the poor and it's about personal moral contact and it's about the transcendent and it's about, you know, dealing in the secular realm as well. And we don't have to just have this unending war. We can synthesize. That's the hope. The worry, my worry as a, you know, John Paul II Benedict kind of Catholic for the most part, is that that Francis maybe just represents, or, you know, the people around him, the cardinals around him, just represent a continuation of the Civil War, that it's just sort of the re-empowerment of the sort of focus on social justice and only social justice faction within the Church. And there was an address that this cardinal from Honduras gave in the U.S. He was in Dallas, I think, recently, and about sort of the mission of the Church, and he's someone who's very close to Pope Francis. And to me, it was a depressing document because it just seemed to return to the binary. It basically was sort of pitting, instead of synthesizing, it was saying we need to first focus on social justice and then the message of the gospel will be heard. We need to, you know, first focus on, you know, sort of our role in the world, and then we can talk about, you know, talk about the saving work of Jesus Christ and so on. And so it just made me worry that we're just headed for sort of round three, you know, the liberals strike back, when what we need somehow is to get, you know, get into whatever the next phase of Christian witness is supposed to be.
Okay, let's take a turn here. I think all of us are more than faintly curious about how a columnist like yourself relates to the New York Times. Now, you live in Washington, so you obviously don't go into the paper every day and sit at a desk. How do you do your work, and to what degree do you relate to the rest of the editorial staff and the other columnists that we might be familiar with whose work appears regularly in the Times?
I mean, the columnist's job is more sort of inherently more isolated than a reporter's job. And I do actually have the Bureau. The Times has a bureau in Washington, D.C. It's a large bureau, a lot of reporters. And four of the columnists have offices there, including me. So David Brooks, Maureen Dowd, and Tom Friedman all have offices on my hallway. And we share a couple of assistants, and they sit down there as well. And I do go into the office, you know, not as much since we started having children, but mm-hmm. I do go into the office a fair amount. But it's not, the reporters and editors are all sort of involved in a common project, which is sort of the production of the daily newspaper. And the columnists write, you know, we either twice a week, or in my case, I write one column a week, and then a lot, or I try to write a lot, sometimes less, for the website, for my personal blog. And that work is just sort of, for the blog, it's basically just sort of me alone. And then for the columns, I have an editor in New York who I, you know, send the column to and call up and we go over it. But it's not a, you know, she's in New York, I'm here, and we're not sort of sitting around a conference table having long discussions about what the op-ed page should look like. So it's very different. When I worked at The Atlantic, you know, even though I did my own writing for the Atlantic website, I was an editor, and, you know, you were putting out a magazine, and you were sort of part of a common culture. And as a columnist, it's easy, you know, you're a little more detached.
What measure of editorial control do you feel from the editors?
I mean, there's, you know, there are words, curse words you're not allowed to use, because the Times is a family newspaper, even if not every pro-family conservative would see it that way. But it's not, there's not a strong sort of, there's not a heavy editorial.
Nobody's arguing with you about the subject of a...
Not for the most part. I mean, you know, there's an editorial role where they'll say, I don't understand what you're saying here, or I'm not quite clear on what this argument is there. But really, you know, when people ask me, are you constrained as a conservative writing for the Times, the only constraint is just the knowledge that I'm writing for an audience that mostly disagrees with me. And I think that has to shape and, you know, inevitably does shape just the style of arguments that I make. And I'm not, you know, I have a different role as a columnist on any issue, political, cultural, religious, whatever, than somebody who writes for people, for an audience that they whose views they mostly share. If I write, you know, when I used to write pieces for National Review or the Weekly Standard as a conservative, they just had a very different style than the pieces I write for the Times. And I spend a lot of time, you know, there's a sort of tightrope you want to walk where you don't want to, you can fall off on one side and sort of lose the ability to connect with your audience at all and just be sort of, you're just talking past each other. Or you can fall off on the other side and feel like you're just sort of pandering to your audience too much and you're becoming just a kind of, you know, the liberal's favorite conservative, and, oh, Ross is so reasonable, and why can't other conservatives be as reasonable as you are? And I undoubtedly fall off on both sides of the tightrope, but you try to walk in between those alternatives and, you know, be engaged with your readers but challenging them as well. Yeah, and there are ticks you fall into, right? I mean, where I'm very aware that I write a lot of columns where I'll spend the first third sort of saying things that I... saying, well, here's where I agree with liberals about this, this, and this, and then you pivot and you say, but guys, think about it this way or something, mm-hmm. right? And that's, you know, there, as a columnist, there are just those kind of sort of crutches that you fall back on. But it is a different, it's a unique role, and I think it's a very important role. I mean, I think our society and our intellectual discourse is better for having conservative columnists writing for newspapers with a largely liberal audience and liberal columnists writing for papers with a largely conservative audience. So,
how did you land that gig?
There's no sort of wild and crazy story. I was working at The Atlantic. I was blogging a lot there and doing a lot of sort of online writing for The Atlantic in addition to sort of editorial work. And Bill Kristol, the editor of the Weekly Standard, had been hired as the Times call as sort of conservative Times columnist for 2008, for the 2008 campaign. And at the end of the year, there was sort of rumors that they weren't going to renew his contract. And then I had a sort of I'd written an op-ed for the Times op-ed page, and one of the editors said, why don't you come up to New York and have lunch with us? And I just had, that was sort of the first of a series of, I guess you could call them, ambiguous conversations that I had with people at the Times, and that led several months later to them saying, do you want to come work for us? And I said yes, as one does. But there wasn't any sort of, you know, there wasn't any sort of weird initiations into Times rituals or anything. It was the only thing that was interesting was that there was never a sort of explicit like job interview moment. It was a much more sort of conversational.
But there was no doubt in your mind or in theirs that they were hiring you to represent a conservative viewpoint on the editorial page.
I don't think there's, especially I have some knowledge of other people they were talking to at that time, and I have the strong sense that they were particularly interested in having someone who was religious and had socially conservative views on the page.
Okay.
I don't know if it was, you know, I don't think they rightly sort of, I don't think they sort of see it in terms of like, we need to have our token Republican specifically, but I think that they were looking to have on at least some issues a viewpoint that I embody that not many of the other columnists do.
You mentioned some of these things, I thought, in an intriguing way last night, but now as an insider, what's to a group of largely political and certainly religiously conservative people, what should we think about the Gray Lady? And should we read that newspaper?
Well, yes, you should read the New York Times. And not only to keep my children in meals and clothes, but also because the Times is a great newspaper, and it does things that no other newspaper, especially in the current economic climate, does in terms of sort of its coverage of, global affairs and national politics. There's just a level of, a lot of journalism is just how many talented people can you throw at a story? And nobody throws talented people at a story like the New York Times. And it's also important to recognize that, the Times serves multiple, it has multiple purposes, right? And there is a version of the Times, and this is especially true of the Sunday paper, which bundles together news with the book review, the magazine section, the Sunday style section, and so on, that is a kind of, effectively a kind of magazine for, that's pitched very directly to, a upper middle class, liberal, sort of highly educated audience all around the country, not just in New York and Washington, but Seattle and San Francisco and everywhere else. When people think about the Times' liberal bias, right, which is obviously a phrase that comes up a fair amount in my conversations with people, I think they're, in certain ways, they're reacting to that part of the Times' product and sort of just the fact, it's not so much bias, it's a product that's pitched to an audience and written by people who, for people who share that audience's values. So if you look at the way the Times writes about an issue like gay marriage, they write about it in that way because they're writing for a community that has a particular set of assumptions, and that sort of shapes coverage in a way that it isn't even, you know, it's sort of too sort of inevitable to even be described as bias in a certain way. And, you know, if, and then the editorial page, of course, is straightforwardly liberal and makes liberal arguments and so on. And, but it is, and I think should be possible to read the Times as someone who doesn't share the cultural assumptions that undergird a lot of its cultural coverage and certainly doesn't agree with the op-ed, with the editorial page. You should agree with the portion of the op-ed page written by me, of course. But to sort of read that part of the Times as a kind of spectator on, you know, what the liberal intelligentsia thinks and says, and then read the rest of the Times to be informed about exactly what the heck is happening in the world. And it doesn't mean that the Times is the only ingredient in a balanced media diet. I think that the way you know, people talk a lot about sort of polarization in media and, you know, sort of the collapse of neutral, nonpartisan news sources and so on. And I mean, first of all, as a conservative, I never really believed that there were neutral and nonpartisan news sources. But I think that to the extent that there are fewer today, that is an opportunity for readers, for people interested in the world as it actually exists, to, you know, to challenge themselves and to say, look, I'm a conservative. I like to watch Fox News and I like to read the Wall Street Journal, and I'm going to continue to watch Fox News and read the Wall Street Journal, but I'm also going to diversify my diet and read the New York Times and subscribe to the New Republic and so on, and figure out, you know, what the people with whom I disagree are thinking. And that is, and so that's, I said this last night, but that's the advice I give to people who ask, you know, well, what newspaper should I read, and, you know, who should I trust? I don't know who you should trust. I know that the best way to deal with not knowing who you should trust is to read more widely and to just make sure that, you know, if you're getting most of your news from one source, that you have other sources as sort of checks and balances, basically. So, you know, if there are stories that are really important that are never going to be covered by Fox News, just like there are stories that are really important that are never going to be covered by MSNBC, and the trick is to make sure that your media diet is balanced and diverse enough that you're getting as many of those stories and as many of those perspectives as possible. And it will be, it's helpful, you know, it's just one of the problems, I think. One thing that happens a lot in journalism now is, I mean, journalists have always gotten hate mail, but the internet makes it easier to send hate mail and easier to leave nasty comments and so on. But one thing that a lot of my colleagues will say, and I don't do this as much because I don't have time to sort of write back to every nasty thing somebody says to me, but a lot of them will say, it's interesting, when I actually write back to people who have written me a nasty note and say, you know, well, here's why I wrote what I wrote, and I'm sorry it made you feel that way, they'll be abashed. And they'll be sort of surprised that, you know, they'll say, oh, well, I'm sorry I lost my temper with you or something. And I think it's very easy in a polarized era where you're getting your news online or on TV to forget that there are actually human beings at the other end of those arguments. And those human beings have reasons, maybe incorrect reasons, but reasons for taking the positions that they take. And the virtue of a more balanced media diet is that it reminds you of that, right? It reminds you that as much as you may dislike President Obama and liberals, or as much as you may dislike President Bush and, you know, or someday President Ted Cruz and conservatives, that, you know, these are people like you who have what they think are good reasons for holding the beliefs that they hold. And keeping that in mind would go a long way towards sort of at least, I don't know if, you know, how many bridges it can actually build, but it can at least sort of cool some of the sense that people have. I mean, the big thing that happens now in our politics is when Bush was president, liberals felt like their country had been taken away from them. And then Obama became president and conservatives felt like their country had been taken away from them. And that's just not a healthy way for our politics to work because, you know, we have a two-party system. Somebody you don't like is going to be president about 50% of the time. And I remember coming into the office at the Atlantic the day after Bush was reelected, you know, by 2.5 percentage points or whatever, and one of my liberal friends said, I feel like I don't belong in this country anymore. And I hear that a lot from conservative audiences in the age of Obama. And, you know, I mean, as Christians, we don't really belong in, you know, we have another country that we're headed towards. But in the moment, you know, for the time being, we have to deal with the reality that this is a divided country, and you know our friends and neighbors are going to vote for politicians who we don't like. And as big as the differences are on some issues, and you know the differences on some of the issues I wrote about in Bad Religion are huge, right? These are fundamental differences of worldviews. In a lot of cases, the arguments we're having in our politics are just not that big. Like, you know, you go back 50, 100 years, people were having real arguments about whether we should be communists or whether we should be fascists, right? And now we're having arguments about whether we should tax the upper, you know, the upper middle class and the rich at 38% or 32%. And that's an important argument, but it's important to sort of keep it in perspective and remember that it isn't a choice. Every election is not a choice between communism and fascism. It's a choice between, you know, where are you setting a tax rate? So that's okay. Sort of.
Let me follow up and ask this. The publisher of the Times has wondered whether the paper will be published in a print edition 10 years from now. And he actually made that statement several years ago. How do you see that change affecting the politics, the social discourse, maybe even the opportunity for better things in the country? Or do you think that's simply an alternation of technology and not content specific?
No, I think it's a big change. I mean, I think actually the print edition, based on what I've seen, the print edition will survive for longer than maybe he expected then. That the, you know, there's a stability to print subscriptions with a paper that has a strong brand identity for like the Times. It's probably going to keep print cost effective for longer than a decade. So I don't know for certain. But I think overall it's clear that, you know, people, you know, my generation and younger especially, are going to get all their news online for the foreseeable future. And I don't know what it means exactly. I think it can go in multiple directions. You know, there is a sense in which it can encourage political polarization because people can sort of, you know, build communities of the like-minded and, you know, never be confronted with, you know, I mean, the theory of an op-ed page in a daily newspaper is you're supposed to have a diversity of views, and so you're always being challenged. And, you know, online you can theoretically seal yourself off from those views. On the other hand, you know, I grew up pre-internet, and I remember reading newspapers and sort of how I got my news as a teenager and what columnists I read and so on. And the reality is that if you're interested and if you make the effort, the diversity of viewpoints online is incredible. And the ability to sort of, you know, as much stupid stuff as there is, as many, you know, cat slideshows, which will feature prominently in my wife's best-selling book that all of you will buy, you know, as much of that stuff as there is, there's also an opportunity, and I think this is particularly important for Christians, right, that, you know, there's an opportunity to have views that sort of don't fit with dominant paradigms, opportunity for those views to have platforms and find audiences that wasn't always true in the era of print. And it's challenging for, you know, Christian publications that were built for an age of print. I know that, like, Christianity Today and its Books and Culture, its Book Review, are sort of have had financial struggles in the past couple of years that, you know, mirror the struggles that, you know, secular newspapers have had. But in terms of the arguments themselves, in terms of, you know, the message of the gospel and what that message means for politics and culture and so on, there is just, you know, the internet affords opportunities to have arguments and sort of hear voices that if you were only getting your news from the Seattle Times or something for 25 years just wasn't possible. And so that's sort of the optimistic spin, I guess I would say, that, you know, it feeds a lot of the trends that I'm lamenting in my book, this sort of, you know, hyper-individualism and sort of social isolation, and you have your fake friends on Facebook and so on, but you don't have real flesh and blood friendships and so on. So I'm a techno-pessimist in that sense, but there is also there are upsides, I guess, in for what's available in terms of your media diet and to the extent to which you can be challenged, but also find sort of, you know, strong voices and so on that you wouldn't have heard before. And I do think it is better, the quality of argument is better online than it is on television by a long shot. It's also worse online in certain ways. Again, in the comment sections, don't do it. But it's better. Television is just a medium that feeds off polarization, feeds off two people shouting at each other. And the internet can be much more discursive, much more deliberative, much more space for sort of real engagement to happen. So that's the more optimistic case.
Okay, as we close, get near to the close here, back to the book. You say in the book that you wrote it in something of a spirit of pessimism. Last night you mentioned you're more pessimistic about the near-term future than perhaps the long-term future, so comment on that. But also, give us what you would have us take away as lessons or challenges for ourselves from the story of the last 50 years of American Christianity and its decline.
So to the first point, about sort of near-term pessimism, long-term optimism. I think, you know, near-term pessimism is just rooted in the fact that all of the trends that I describe in the book that are sort of undercutting institutional Christianity right now seem to be accelerating. Our society is getting more fragmented, sort of more atomized. You know, these sort of community institutions are weakening, the family is weakening, and so on. And this is, in turn, feeding this spirit of sort of, you know, that religion is just a do-it-yourself affair, and you know, you can seek God just by sort of picking pieces from different traditions, and it isn't possible that one particular church could, you know, actually offer the fullness of truth, and so on. So those trends are accelerating. At the same time, those trends are deeply problematic for American society, and it really isn't the case that you can have, you know, a sort of successful society, I think, ultimately built on sort of, you know, do-it-yourself religion, do-it-yourself everything. People need community. They need relationships. They need they need what institutional religion ultimately has to offer. And so I at the same time, I think that, you know, it isn't the case that institutional Christianity is about to disappear. And I've, you know, been sort of traveling the country promoting the book, and I've told people it inevitably makes you more optimistic to go around the country and sort of see the resilience and vitality of both Catholicism and Protestantism in communities all around the country. And so if that resilience exists, and if Christian communities are there to offer an alternative to the endpoint of, frankly, sort of loneliness and isolation that our current social and religious model is leading to, then I think that there you can see, you know, you can see at least the seeds of a real sort of Christian and, you know, American cultural recovery on a sort of multi-generational timescale. The demographics of a society of, you know, people who stay single for 20 years and maybe have a child and get divorced and, you know, grow old alone and so on, that model can't sustain itself, presumably, forever. It can sustain itself in a way that, you know, will make people exhausted and unhappy, which I guess is the more likely scenario.